The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis Podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show. Over the next few episodes, we're going to be hearing from Peter S. Williams, a Christian philosopher and apologist. Back in 2013, Unbelievable held a conference around apologetics and C.S. Lewis, and the conference was called Jesus, Liar, Lunatic, Legend or Lord. Here, Peter gave a seminar on the topic, if C.S. Lewis met Dawkins, how would he respond to the new atheists? This is what Peter had to say.
Secondly, Dawkins has a self-contradictory view of freedom and responsibility. God created things that had free will, said Lewis. Creatures can go wrong or right. The law of gravity tells you what stones do if you drop them, but the law of human nature, the moral law in this context, tells you what human beings ought to do and not to do. If you're walking along underneath a cliff and a pebble falls through the air and hits you on the head, and you believe that the reason that pebble has hit you on the head and caused you pain is that once upon a time a pebble lived in the edge of the cliff, in the soil, and over lots of years of soil erosion and rain and ice forming and melting and so on, it had become exposed to the elements. And just as you were walking along the beach, a particularly large gust of wind at just the right angle happened to it off the top of the cliff, and gravity took hold of it, and it bounced, describes a perfect parabola according to Newton's law, through the air, hits you on the head, bump. If you saw someone hit on the head like that, and you knew that's why they believed they were hit on the head, and they reacted to that situation by doing something like this, bump. Oh, good grief, gravity, what do you think you're up to? That's really naughty soil erosion. You would be calling for the men in white coats. You think that is not a rational response to that situation. On the other hand, if you saw them be hit by a pebble on the head and you look up to the top of the cliff and there's me at the top of the cliff going, come on. And that person were to point at me and say things along the lines of perhaps a little bit more colourfully, but you know, that was very naughty, Peter, you shouldn't do that. You think that's an eminently reasonable response to the situation. On the one hand, you think there is a merely material system of cause and effect behaving according to the laws of physics, and it does not make sense to blame it and hold it morally responsible. On the other hand, there's me, and you think it makes sense to blame me and hold me morally responsible, which means your intuition is, I am not merely a purely physical system behaving according to the laws of physics, full stop. So the naturalistic argument against free will is kind of an inversion of this. It says, look, purely physical systems behave according to the laws of physics and so lack libertarian free will, the kind of free will that links with moral responsibility. Secondly, human beings are purely, from the naturalistic viewpoint, physical systems, full stop. Conclusion, therefore, human beings lack libertarian free will. Just as logically valid as an argument as the one I just gave you. I would say the problem here is that premise two is wrong. You have to weigh that in the balance with your intuitions. Have a think about that one. But here's Dawkins on determinism. He says this, human brains, which for him is the same thing as your mind, there's no distinction. Human brains, though they might not work in the same way as man-made computers, are as surely governed by the laws of physics. When a computer malfunctions, we do not punish it. That would be silly. We track down the problem and fix it. Isn't the murderer just a machine with a defective component? Or a defective upbringing? Defective education? Defective genes? Concepts like blame and responsibility are bandied around freely, interesting use of the term, freely where human wrongdoers are concerned. But doesn't a mechanistic view of the nervous system, a materialistic understanding of what a person is, make nonsense of the very idea of responsibility? Any crime, says Dawkins, is in principle to be blamed on, not the person who commits the crime, blamed on antecedent conditions, previous conditions, acting through the accused's physiology, heredity, and environment. Why do we vent such visceral hatred on child murderers or people who try and behead other people in broad daylight when we should simply, again, interesting use of should, simply regard them as faulty units that need fixing or replacing? There is Dawkins, and in one sense, I'd say to him, it is good to see you being trying to work out consistently the ramifications of your belief system. That argument is logically valid. If I believed both premises, I would have to agree with you that that conclusion is true, and that people lack libertarian free will and they lack moral responsibility. That is at least consistent. But here's a question for Dawkins. If everything about a person is governed by the laws of physics, as he says, blaming them for their intellectual failings, such as, I don't know, having blind faith, surely that makes about as much sense as Newton blaming gravity for giving him an apple-sized bump on the head. Or that person blaming rocks and soil erosion and gravity for hurting them. So how can anyone, for example, a Christian, be responsible for not living up to their intellectual obligations if they aren't free to be responsible for anything in the first place? The obvious answer, it seems to me, is they cannot. And that's a self-contradiction within Dawkins's viewpoint. Indeed, how can anyone feel an intellectual obligation to agree with a worldview, such as naturalism, that denies any reality to intellectual obligations? It seems to me they can't. Here we get a little diversion to Lewis's anti-naturalism argument from reason, which is being much discussed by contemporary philosophers of religion, this kind of argument. He makes... This is the hardest philosophical bit of the lecture, so bear with me, it'll be over quickly. Lewis makes a distinction, philosophers love distinctions, between I believe X because of Y. What do we mean when we say that kind of thing? The relation of physical cause and effect on the one hand, as in grandfather is ill today because, cause and effect, sense of because, he ate the lobster yesterday and it was off. Okay, that's why he's ill. And then on the other hand, we could have the relation, not of physical cause and effect, but of logical ground and consequent conclusion. As in, grandfather must be ill because, ground consequent, he hasn't got up yet. And we know that he is invariably an early riser when he's well. Okay, see the difference. Grandpa's failure to get out of bed doesn't cause grandfather to be ill. Nor does it cause us to conclude that he's ill. Rather, it is our grounds for making the logical inference that he is ill. The lobster caused him to be ill. His not getting out of bed doesn't cause us to make the right conclusion. We have to reason correctly. That's what reasoning is about. Are we reasoning correctly or are we reasoning incorrectly? As the atheist philosopher Thomas Nagel recently stated, if we can reason, it is because our thoughts can obey the order of logical relations among propositions, that is, among truth claims. If this, and if this also is the case, then this is the case. If purely material things don't have free will and people are purely material things, then they don't have free will. That's the logical relations between those statements. But Lewis points out that a train of reasoning has no value as a means of finding truth unless each step in it is connected with what went before in the ground-consequent relationship. If what we think at the end of our reasoning is to be a valid conclusion, the correct answer to the question, why do you think that, must begin with the ground-consequent sense of, well, I think that because, and here's my reasons. On the other hand, every event in nature, on the naturalistic viewpoint, must be connected with previous events, antecedent conditions, in Dawkins' phrase, in the cause and effect relation. But if naturalism is true, our acts of thinking just are events in nature. There's no distinction between your mind and your brain. Therefore, the true answer to why do you think this, for example, why do you think that naturalism is true, must begin with the cause and effect sense of because I was caused to believe that. Now, this is a problem, says Lewis, because to be caused is not to be proved. Those are different things. Wishful thinking, prejudice, the delusions of madness, they're all caused, but they are ungrounded. They're not rational conclusions of arguments. So you could boil down the argument to this. One, naturalism reduces reasoning to a closed, mechanistic, deterministic system of physical causes and effect. It would seem that Dawkins, from what he said, would have to agree with that. Two, Lewis points out this reduction cannot accommodate acts of reasoning, including the naturalist's acts of reasoning. Three, therefore, it follows, naturalism is self-contradictory. And reason must be viewed as a fundamental cause, not something that is reducible to cause and effect. It's not in the beginning was the matter cause and effect, and somehow that produces reason. That doesn't seem to work. But if you invert that and said in the beginning was the word, things fall into place much more neatly. In 2011, the philosopher Paul Copan posed this very question to Richard Dawkins, and it is instructive to see how Dawkins dealt with this issue of the self-contradictory nature of rationality under a naturalistic worldview. Copan asked Dawkins this. He says, you say in River Out of Eden that we are, quote, dancing to our DNA. It seems hard to differentiate between the arguments of the atheist, who believes himself to be more rational than the theist, when actually the same non-rational physical genetic forces are at work in both. So that even if the atheist is correct, it seems to me that it would be completely by accident rather than by virtue or rationality that the atheist has. So I was curious as to what you'd say in response to that. It summarizes the question. If the same purely material forces are at work in both the atheist and the theist, why would we consider the atheist to be more rational?
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation.
Here verbatim is Dawkins' response. I'm not quite sure I've got this. I mean, the same forces are shaping both the atheist and the theist, and indeed everybody, yet we come to different conclusions. Is your problem, how is it that we can come to different conclusions if our brains are shaped by the same forces? No, that wasn't the question. So Copan says, clarify, my question is, why should the atheist believe he is more rational than the theist if the same forces are at work in both of them? Forces beyond their control, out of their rational responsibilities. Dawkins, you could ask the same question about any difference of opinion. Well, yes, you could. So, you know, what's the answer? That's completely irrelevant. Then he changes the subject. He says, if you were to ask me a completely different question, which I will then answer, ask me why I'm confident that my scientific rationalism is, and I think he was going to say true or rational or something there, but thought better of it, he substitutes the right answer. I mean, the answer is that it works. But as Copan points out in response, as philosophers like Alvin Plantinga point out in response, that's no reply, because what works isn't necessarily what's true. Indeed, lies can work, and they, by definition, are false. Okay? So by sundering apart truth and rationality from what works, this naturalistic view of humanity sinks rationality. Dawkins has a self-contradictory view of ethics. Despite his constant moralizing, especially against the evils of religion, and we should grant Dawkins and his ilk that religion and religious people in particular do many evil things, but that concession is not going to help them much, because Dawkins's scientism leads him to reject the objective reality of moral values. Remember back to the fact-value divide. If there's a distinction between facts and values, which are not facts, so what if you say that's evil? That's not a fact. In order for that to be a complaint that you can rationally make, don't you need the value to be a fact? Don't you need to be able to say to religious people, you really ought not to behave like that, rather than it just be your subjective cultural fancy? In God's Utility Function, published in Scientific American, Dawkins says this. Alistair McGrath was summarizing from this earlier. He says, the universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. More recently, he said, there is a non-overlapping and exhaustive distinction between ideas that are false or true about the real world, factual matters in the broad sense, and ideas about what we ought to do, normative or moral ideas for which the words true and false have no meaning. Have no meaning. He's into a sort of verificationist theory of morality here. This is a very extreme form of empiricism. So in The God Delusion, when Richard Dawkins says things like Hitler and Stalin were, by any standards, spectacularly evil men, well, I want to agree with him, but I do want to point out to him that he's also said that there are no standards. And he doesn't mean it. When he says faith, blind faith, a misunderstanding of faith, but what he conceives of faith, blind faith, is an evil precisely because it requires no justification and brooks no argument, he doesn't mean it. Out of his own mouth, he tells us that he doesn't mean it. And if he doesn't mean it, then it's not really a very powerful criticism to launch. If he wants to launch the criticism, fine, but then he has to admit that there really are objective values, ways that people should and should not behave, that we discover rather than invent. So, Dawkins tells us, one, we have an objective moral obligation to oppose religion because religion is an objectively bad thing in that it encourages people to ignore their intellectual moral obligations. And by the way, there are no objective moral values. And even if there were, you wouldn't be responsible for whether or not you followed them or not because you don't have any free will. But for Lewis, even Lewis the atheist, evil was an objective fact. He said it was a real thing, a thing that is really there, not made up by ourselves. As an atheist, Lewis believed that evil was something that any god worthy of the name objectively ought not to permit. He said, several years before I read Lucretius, I felt the force of his argument, and it is surely the strongest of all for atheism. Had God designed the world, it would not be a world so frail and faulty as we see. He should have done better if he was there. Okay? Now, it's interesting to note that very rarely will you come across the problem of evil as an argument against belief in God in the writings of any new atheist. Well, you can see why, because for them, most of them, there is no evil. My argument against God, says Lewis in Mere Christianity, was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? If the whole show was bad and senseless from A to Z, so to speak, why did I, who was supposed to be part of the show, find myself in such violent reaction to it? A man feels wet when he falls into water because a man is not a water animal. A fish wouldn't feel wet. I don't know, I've never asked one, but yes, you get the analogy. Of course, I could have given up my idea of justice by saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own. That's the route Richard Dawkins takes. But if I did that, said Lewis, then my argument against God collapsed too. For the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust, not simply that it didn't happen to please my fancies. Thus, in the very act of trying to prove that God did not exist, that the whole of reality was senseless, I found I was forced to assume that one part of reality, my idea of justice, was full of sense. Consequently, atheism turns out to be too simple. He extends it into his famous presentation of the moral argument, which is really a popularization of a moral argument given by a philosopher called W.R. Sawley, who you can look up if you want to. Says, if nature, if the space-time-matter system is the only thing in existence, then of course there can be no other source for our standards. They must, like everything else, be the unintended and meaningless outcome of blind forces. All we say about nature red in tooth and claws, quite inexplicable on the theory that we are simply natural creatures. If this world is the only world, how did we come to find its laws either so dreadful or comic? If there's no straight line elsewhere, how do we discover that nature's line is crooked? He's gesturing towards this. If metaphysical naturalism is true, then nothing is objectively evil. Richard Dawkins grants that premise. The atheist Lewis didn't. But something is objectively evil. Dawkins will reject that premise. Lewis, even as an atheist, wanted to hold on to that so he could have his moral argument against God. But if both of those premises are true, if given metaphysical naturalism, nothing is objectively evil, but given that something is objectively evil, then it follows that metaphysical naturalism is false. Indeed, you can extend it. If a wholly good personal God doesn't exist to ground, to be the standard, to be a standard that not only transcends us that we can discover, but a standard capable of rightfully demanding our allegiance, our obligation. You can't be obliged by something non-personal. Nor can non-personal things really issue prescriptions and commandments to you. But if the moral law is an objective, transcendent law that prescribes, that obligates our behavior, it has to be a personal reality that rightfully demands our entire allegiance. That's starting to sound a lot like God, isn't it? If there's no such being, if you don't bring such an explanation into the picture, you don't get an explanation for the existence of objective values. And given that they do exist, this is at least some reason to believe in the existence of that kind of a God. As Lewis puts it in his fantastic little essay, De Futilitate, the defiance of the good atheist, and he's walked in these shoes, the defiance of the good atheist, hurled in an apparently ruthless and idiotic cosmos, is really an unconscious homage to something in or behind that cosmos which he recognizes as infinitely valuable and authoritative. For if mercy and justice were really only private whims of his own, he could not go on being indignant. The fact that he arraigns heaven itself for disregarding them means that at some level of his mind, he knows that they are enthroned in a higher heaven still.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.